Well, it is a great pleasure for my latest Nostalgia interview to be joined by Mark Stay. Not for the first time, Mark.
Yes, hello. How are you?
I'm fine. Well, I've just come off the radio. Not that that's, you know, the typical line that somebody uses when they meet up with a guest to do a podcast. But of course, we've met on the radio and on TV.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. Yes. Yes, Mr. Media, you are.
Yeah. Well, I try. And I sometimes forget exactly which room I'm in at any moment. And of course, we had a book launch the other day of our good friend Malcolm's latest Return to Everywhere Street.
Yeah, that was terrific. Malcolm really pulls in a crowd, doesn't he?
Yeah.
He's a local celeb. So, it's... And this is the nice thing about Herne Bay now is... I mean, maybe it's always been like this. We've been here about 8 years, 7 or 8 years. And there are these little hubs, you know, since we had the Little Green Bookshop come along, you know, I've met a lot more bookish people here. They all seem to be in Whitstable, but they seem to come from Whitstable in this direction, which is nice, because Whitstable's full of arty types, and they're all heading in this direction, which can only be a good thing, I think.
And it's always really surprising in some cases when you go to a place and, you know, when you start doing a bit of digging, you realise what a great cultural site it is. Because I'm not going to use the word emigre, but there are people who used to work at the University of Kent, for example, who are now very much sort of based in and around the area and suddenly doing something very different. Obviously, I'm thinking of Malcolm here. And you sometimes think, yeah, it's lovely by the sea as well. It's kind of, for me, a really, it's got everything. Herne Bay sort of just has that, you know, you've got this, if you like the traditional seaside, you've got that. But there's also a lot of other things going on, which can be, you know, really good as far as local cultural events.
Absolutely. Great music, great art. My cousin Nick, who runs the Shakers hair salon, he's also a street artist as well, and there are bits of his street art all over Herne Bay as well, you know. So it's especially in these dark times that we live in, where it seems like we're all going to hell in a handcart, and maybe we'll talk about that later, that idea where actually I think things are actually getting better. But, you know, in these dark times, it's nice to see these little, you know, candles in the dark, as it were.
Yeah, and I'm fascinated to know how the journey started for you, because I know, obviously, you worked in a bookshop and obviously you write wonderful fantasy fiction. But how did the journey start for you? So, first of all, where were you born?
I was born St Thomas's Hospital, opposite Big Ben, as it was striking 10 o'clock, according to my mother, in a ward haunted by Florence Nightingale. So that was a good start. But yeah, I grew up in various bits of London. We were in Plumstead to start with, then Hornsey until I was about 8 years old, I think. I used to go to Duncombe School in North London. And even then, I had really good teachers. And this is the thing that's running all the way through my school years, is you know, my parents were encouraging me, my teachers were encouraging me. We went to the library, and I was constantly nudged towards creativity, if it's drawing or art or acting or writing or whatever. So I was, you know, I had a great childhood. I know, you know, we like to think of artists as having a tortured childhood, but I had a terrific childhood. Because then when we moved out of London, we moved to Leafy Leatherhead in Surrey, and my dad got a school caretaker job. And so he was the caretaker of my middle school. And at the weekend, I had the run of the fields. So we had fields, we had an adventure playground. If it was raining, we'd go inside and use the, you used to get the equipment out, gym equipment out. So I was always jumping off roofs, swinging on ropes, all that kind of thing. Until I was about sort of 15, 16, I didn't grow up. And probably still haven't. So I had a very fun, adventurous childhood. And I saw Star Wars when I was five. I've always said that was kind of the thing that, up till then, I wanted to be a firefighter. We had a fire engine come to our school. I got to sit in the front, put the hat on. I thought, this is the life for me, climbing up ladders, rescuing cats, that sort of thing. But then Dad took me to see Star Wars when it was, you know, this would have been February 78. So I think it was released in London in December 77 and then went wide not long after that. And how do I get to do that? What is that? How do I get into that? Do I step through the screen? What does it work like? And I remember at a school jumble sale, there I got a hardcover copy of the Star Wars novelization, and it had, you know, 8 full coloured pages of, you know, blah, 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 photos. And in there it talked about the director and the writer. And I was like, oh, people make this stuff. So from then on, I was obsessed with it. But it was a working class family. We didn't know anyone, in theatre or film or anything like that, but I had good teachers who encouraged me to keep pursuing it. And occasionally I'll get little glimpses into this world where, like, my uncle had a stall in the lane in Walworth, and he knew a stuntman called Nosher Powell, who you might, if you watched Minder in the 80s, he always played a heavy or whatever. And he'd been a stormtrooper in Star Wars. So that was, what? Wow, that's amazing. And then, a friend of mine worked at an edit suite and he knew a film director. And it's just bit by bit you start to realise these people are all around you, you know.
Because sometimes you wonder growing up whether they are, you know, it's an impenetrable world, because you can grow up with people on the radio and you feel that you know them. They're friends who inhabit your living room or your car or the drive to school. But I was never the sort of person who would then contact these people. You know, I would never, I mean, when I'm on the radio, I encourage listeners to contact the show.
Yeah.
But I would never have done that when I was young.
No, well, I'll give you an example of when I bottled it once. A friend of mine, his brother, Simon, worked on an edit suite in West Hill and Wandsworth. And upstairs, and this was the early 90s, upstairs was a film director called Vadim Jean, who made a film called Leon the Pig Farmer, which you may or may not
remember.
I have
heard of it, yes.
Low-budget movie, actually made a ton of money, did really well as a kind of cult hit. And then years later, he went on to do the Terry Pratchett shows for Sky. And to start with, I primarily wanted to act, and I was concentrating on my acting. And Simon said, yeah, there's a film director upstairs, why don't you, I'll let him know about you. And Vadim called my house, and I was out, and my dad took the call. And he said, some film director bloke called you, here's his number. And I couldn't think of what to say to him. And I bottled it. I completely bottled it. Now, weirdly, it all sort of came full circle, because years later I was working at Orion Publishing and we did the books of the making of, you know, The Hogfather and stuff like that. And I met Vadim again. And I told him all about it. And he said, I know what it's like, but, you know, always make that call. Always make that call. And I did a talk at Christchurch, Canterbury the other day. And I did the same thing. I said, look, this industry is so much about who you know. I said, you lot all know me. There's a contact form on my website. If you've ever got a question, drop me a line. And whenever I do these things at universities, you know, there's one person who, and I've had that one response. You know, I've had that one person drop me a line. And it just astonishes me they don't all do it. I'm not saying I'm some big highfalutin, you know, I'm going to make you a star kind of thing, but I know the industry, and if ever comes to, look, I've been approached by this agent or this producer, are they on the line? Should I be wary? I can help you with that. I can help you negotiate that kind of stuff. So, which is what I would have really, really, you know, needed when I was their age. So I understand that trepidation and that thing of, oh, God, what are we going to talk about? It's like if you ever meet a famous person, you might think, I've always wanted to meet this person, but what's my in? What are we actually going to talk about? You know, it's not like they're going to fall in love with me and go on holiday or whatever or run away. So it's this weird, awkward interaction that we have with the people who can probably be really, really helpful to us. So I've learned by error, trial and error, to not be backwards and coming forwards and just saying, look, you know, I'm a writer, man. And this is the other thing as well, particularly with young writers and actors. If they've not achieved anything in terms of, oh, I've not been published, or I've not, you know, got an agent or whatever, they're scared to call themselves a writer, an actor, a musician, or whatever it is they're doing. But if you're writing, you're a writer. If you're acting, that is putting on theatre or putting stuff on YouTube or whatever it is you're doing, you're an actor. If you're making music, you're a musician. It's as simple as that. And if you have the ambition to follow that through to some kind of career, or if you have some kind of clear goal in mind, then why shouldn't you approach other people and say, look, can you help me with this? Can you give me some guidance?
Yes, because, I mean, there's the obvious fear of rejection, but it happened to me with students,
right,
who I was teaching on a particular, like Richard Dawkins actually was one example. One of my students wrote to Dawkins and
right,
actually said, I've been studying you in my class. And apparently he wrote back and said, oh, but you're doing a degree in theology or religious studies. That's a waste of time. So, of course, he just came, so in other words, he just gave the stock answer rather than, I'm deeply touched that you're studying me. And another one was actually a theologian called Don Cupid, who I had been teaching for many, many years, and he's one of the few people on that particular course who's still alive. He's now 90. And the student said, you know, based on that class, she said, I'm just going to contact him. And she said he wrote back and invited me to meet him. And I'm thinking, hang on a minute, I've been teaching this person week in, week out, and as a result of me simply talking about him and you being interested in his work, you actually did that very thing. So you're right, that's proof that if you really want to follow through on something, then it can happen. And I suppose the fear is when they turn out maybe not to be nice enough to reply.
Yes, or, you know, never meet your heroes sometimes. It's but, you know, I'm not anyone's hero, but it's, you know, I'm someone in the industry. And I think, yes, all right. And one of the things that, you know, I did a podcast called The Bestseller Experiment. I've got my own podcast now. And we've interviewed authors all across the spectrum, some traditionally published, some self-published. And we've all interviewed some really famous ones, really sort of big household names like, you know, Michael Connelly and Sarah Pimber and people like that. And they've always been absolutely brilliant. But I always find the authors that I learn the most useful stuff from are the ones who are sort of two-thirds up the ladder. They've had a couple of books out. They're a bit battered and bruised, but they're still going. And in a way, I think listeners learn more from them than anyone else. They're not quite your peers. They're maybe a few steps ahead of you, but they've made the mistakes and they're still going for some reason, you know. So it's it's all very well asking, Dan Brown for advice, but I'm not sure how useful that's going to be.
Yes, and I remember actually once coming really close, because I'd just written a book on Christmas, and there was a case study of Ed Stewart, who used to be, you know, Junior Choice back in the day, radio legend. And I thought, well, I've written on his program.
Stewart,
yeah. And actually, his show was on the radio the morning I was born. So you have your birth narrative at the start of the night. So I've created an entire sort of origin story.
Three wise men.
And even when I got married, all the key events in my life, you know, he was on the radio, literally, actually. And I wrote him, and the day I was going to write to him to say the proof had just come from the publisher, he actually died. So that for me, that was the lesson of, you know, don't leave it too late. Yeah. And since then, I've been in touch with people who knew him, and they all said, yeah, if you'd written, he would have replied. Because my fear was maybe either you don't get a reply at all, or you get a letter back that you think, oh, maybe maybe I shouldn't have gone ahead with that.
Yeah, I worked in publishing for a long time, bookselling and publishing, and you meet a lot of famous people. And albeit very, very briefly, they're in and out of you. You know, they'll do an event or whatever. And you learn they're just human beings like anyone else. And you learn very soon that you don't want to be famous. I sort of gave up on the acting thing quite soon after moving into bookselling. One, because it became very clear that I wasn't going to be Harrison Ford or Michael Caine. But also, I was a bag of nerves going on stage. And I preferred the writing. I was enjoying the writing. My wife and I formed a little theatre company. So my wife went to drama school for 3 years. I got into drama school. She got the grant. That's how old we are. And I was working at Waterstones. So I said, well, I like working at Waterstones. I'll stay there. You come back, teach me everything you know. And then when she came out, we formed our own little theatre company. And we put on plays at a local theatre in Epsom. And we did quite well. You know, we did a Mamet play and stuff like that. And I wanted to do a play by Johnny Spate, called The Compartment, which had been a television play starring Michael Caine. And Michael Caine, we talk about seeing people and being inspired by them. Michael Caine came from the same sort of part of London as my family. I also got told off a lot because whenever I acted and slowed down my voice, I started to sound like Michael Caine. So I had people say, stop doing your Michael Caine impression. I said, it's not. It's just if I slow down my voice, that's what I sound like. And I wanted to do this play, The Compartment, because it was a good showcase. And I thought we could do this, we could take it around, and maybe I'll be plucked from obscurity and, you know, whatever. And then Johnny Spate died, and the family, I think, withdrew the rights, or someone withdrew the estate. And so I had a venue booked and no play. And in about 8 weeks, I wrote a play about all the terrible camping holidays my family had taken me on as a kid. And which is an idea that had been boiling inside. I'm a big Mike Leigh fan as well.
Oh, yes.
And that kind of Mike Leigh, you know, John Sullivan meets Mike Leigh kind of, you know, working class family thing going. And I wrote it, and it was really fun to write. And I was essentially playing my dad, which he picked up on and threatened to sue me. Or have 10% of the profits, whichever was greater. And it went down really, really well. We did it for a few nights at this local theatre. Lots of laughs. And like I said, I didn't really know anyone in the industry except a friend of mine was what they called a cable basher on TFI Friday, if you remember that, the Chris Evans show.
Yes.
And this is my friend Jeremy. And he, you know, he's made documentaries and does music videos and all sorts of stuff now. But he was my one person in the industry who knew maybe what he was on about. And he took me to one side after the play. He said, "There are too many actors, but not enough writers. You can write. Keep writing." Which I think was his way of telling me I was a terrible actor. But it was a big trigger for me, because I thought, okay, let's focus on the writing. I enjoy the writing. It's something that makes sense to me. Let's give it a go. And so for the next sort of 3 or 4 years, we did a play a year. Oh, you know, I had a day job and everything else. I was working in publishing. We did a play a year, and I learned something every single time, because you can't beat doing a performance in front of an audience, because you pick up on what works and what doesn't very, very quickly. And then we took one of my scripts up to Edinburgh, and that was fun, even though we lost a ton of money, as do most people who go to Edinburgh. And I turned that one into a screenplay, and that was my first sort of attempt at script. I'd written and shot 3 short films with my friend Jeremy, because he was able to get camera equipment at the weekends, no iPhones or anything then. And my friend with the edit suite, below Vadim Jean, he edited them for me. Again, this is kind of, you know, it is who you know, this industry. And you might not know the famous people, but your peers who rise up with you, you know, those are the ones who are going to help you out. And so, you know, I made 3 short films, which weren't great, but I learned a lot doing them. If anyone, you know, is a young screenwriter and asks for advice, I say make a short film, because you can do it all on your phone now. And it's you'll learn, you know, writing, you write a film 3 times, once on paper, then in the edit. On the shoot and then in the edit suite. You learn so much from doing that. And so I made 3 short films and then wrote a full-length screenplay, which has never been made, but it got me an agent and got me on the path where I am today. And I met the director, John Wright, who I then went on to make Robot Overlords and I'm Welcome With, and we've written all sorts of stuff together. So it was just, you know, and it is continues to be a story of just plugging away.
I mean, there's something about that resilience, isn't there? Because if you know there's something you want to do, I mean, the irony in my case is that I had a full career and in a way thrived at it, but I always knew it wasn't the thing I wanted to do. But yeah. I also just thought, well, that's life.
Well, I mean, you know, my wife and I, we got married quite young. I was 21. We wanted a place of our own, which you could do back in the 90s, if you remember that. You can't do it now. And we wanted a family, which I couldn't do in a bookseller's way. So I sort of sold myself for a company car and joined a publisher and became a sales rep on the road. And that was quite good money. And I got a car out of it too. And then you do get, I enjoyed it at first very much. And I moved to Orion and that was terrific. But eventually it became, I'm sitting here. I used to sell books and I loved the selling books and driving around and engaging with booksellers and selling things. But eventually I ended up just filling out spreadsheets for Amazon. I remember, you know, a couple of years before I was made redundant, I was like, why am I doing this? This is soul destroying. But while all that was going on, I'm writing on my commute. I'm writing on my lunch break. Every spare minute I've got, I'm working on stuff, you know, and working on that writing career and just learning my craft and getting, you know, feedback. And, you know, not everything works. Not everything gets picked up. You have little adventures on the way where you almost write a novel for the Duchess of Northumberland. That's a story and a half. You know, you almost write a TV show, you almost write a movie, and they never quite happen, but you keep plugging. And then, you know, I remember interviewing the fantasy author Joe Abercrombie on the podcast, and he's the phrase that he comes up with, you know, sticks with me. He says, the longer you keep dancing naked in the rain, the more likely you are to be struck by lightning. And that's what, you know, has kept me going and still does today, because, you know, there are highs and lows. I'm in a bit of a low at the moment. I'm not earning any money. You know, I've got stuff out in submission and the publishing and film and TV industry are paralyzed with indecision at the moment. You know, the phrase I keep hearing is survive till 25. You know, it's almost as if this year has been written off already. So it's, you know, there are difficult times, but there are the highs as well. And I've been doing this long enough to realize that it waxes and wanes, they come and go, you know. So it's, you just got to keep on plugging away.
Is there something about role models and whether they're the right role models? Because I remember when I was a student and I did a PhD, and you're sort of almost thinking, ooh, that tutor or that other student, you know, saw me out drinking the other night, and they might be thinking, ooh, you know, shouldn't he be writing his PhD? And, you know, and in other words, you're always aware of other people's perceptions of what you're doing. But then you look back and you think, hang on a minute, I achieved that, and yet some of those other people that I was looking up to are no longer present. You know, they've gone on to do other things, or maybe they didn't finish what they were doing. And some, you know, people would say, oh, I wrote 20,000 words last month. And you're thinking, I haven't written 20,000. Oh, you know, what's the point of me carrying on? Then you look back and you think, hang on a minute.
You can only run your own race. And I think this is the problem, particularly in publishing, where, you know, a few weeks ago we had the Frankfurt Book Festival, where all the book news was about the six-figure deals. That, you know, they've sold the film rights, they've sold it worldwide, all these translation rights, huge success. But that's the 1% right there. You can only run your own race. And, resilience and persistence counts for a lot too. My wife had a drama school reunion recently, and of course it's about, you know, 30 years since she was at drama school. And out of the whole year that she was in, three of them are still working in the industry. One of whom is Bridget Christie, who's a, you know, stand-up comedian, has got her own TV show on Channel 4. And, you know, a couple are working. One's a stunt coordinator, one's working in theatre, like West End shows. And the story I heard again and again from those who weren't, who were perfectly happy, by the way, not to denigrate, you know, that, but they'd often done it for their mental health. They just decided they didn't want it as much. They just decided that it wasn't worth the struggle or the fight. So either I'm completely deluded or it's kind of, you know, I talk to writer friends and we're like, what else are we going to do? You know, what else? We're no good for anything else. So this is, you know, religious people talk about a calling. And, you know, this is what I'm good at. And going back to the school days, that's what teachers used to pat me on the head. You're good at, you know, you're good at creating things. So that's all I know, really, you know.
Yeah, and you mentioned as well that you know, if you spend a lot of time on the road, as you were doing when you were, you know, involved in publishing and you're encountering a lot of people, in a way, although you could argue that that's time not writing, it's what you do in those moments, like the lunchtime, or you're waiting for a client. I mean, I found this, that sometimes if you, like when I was at school, there would always be that almost like competition, you know, how many hours revision did you do for your exams last night? And if you sit into a room for 16 hours and the idea that somehow you do all your revision, you've done 16 hours, therefore you're going to get a grade A, you know, there's no correlation there. That doesn't normally happen. But somebody who might have a part-time job or somebody who might be, you know, doing their revision, but they're doing it with something else on the go, they may actually do just as well, if not even better, because they have a clearer sense of how they can exploit their time to their own advantage. Well, the idea that somehow the length of time equals quality of product.
I was a late bloomer. I was quite a lazy student. If I say so myself, I was a bit of a clever clogs when it came to certain subjects like literature and art and stuff like that. I had a knack for it. And so I became quite lazy and didn't bother. And where I struggled, like maths or anything like that, I just didn't bother. So I came out with a bunch of very average grades. But, you know, you reach a point in your mid-20s where you realise this isn't a rehearsal and you need to get on with it. And that's when we started putting on plays and such. And I really started knuckling down because I thought, OK, if I don't do something now, I'm just going to end up, wondering what could have been. So, you know, it's all about finding those little moments of the day. On the podcast and everything, you'll hear people say, well, I've got busy lives, I've got commitments. How do I find the time to write? And it's not a question of find. The time is there. You just need to sacrifice, you know, something. You know, don't watch the news for half an hour. You know, don't, you know, do something. You know, we talk about the 200 words a day challenge on the bestseller experiment, where we say, look, just do 20 minutes a day. Try and do 200 words. Either first thing in the morning, your lunch break at the end of the day. If you manage to do that every day, by the end of the year, you've written a novel, first draft of a novel. And if you do, just try it for 5 days, your brain basically rewires itself after 5 days. Because, you know, if you were to say to me, oh, I'm learning the piano, but I'm going to take off 2 or 3 weeks in the summer to do it, I'd think you were mad. But so many people do that when they're writing a novel. They say, yeah, I've got a novel in me. I'm going to take a few weeks off in the summer. I'm going to go on a retreat and write it then. It's like, that's not how it works. Do a little bit every day. You're exercising a muscle. The more you do this stuff, the better you get at it. It's, you know, and the the more adept you get at solving the problems that you encounter. I'm not saying it gets easier, but you learn more and more strategies to cope with when you get stuck and when something isn't working.
No, I think that's really well put, because I've always kept a diary, but when I started at the age of 9, I did it in the summer holidays. And of course, then it was like, school is finished.
Yeah.
And of course, the diary consists of, there's no school, so I'll watch TV and I'll list. This was the Pink Panther Show episode that I saw, and it's
brilliant.
Ludicrous. But I stuck at it. And then over the course of time, obviously I wrote a bit more than what I was watching on TV at 8:30 in the morning in 1987. But time went on, and I now write around 2,000 words a day. And it, you know, it'll take me an hour, maybe a bit longer. But by the end of each month, I've written 60,000 to 70,000 words. But that's just on my diary.
And on the diary,
but that's
right.
an output that isn't technically an output, because nobody apart from me has read it.
Yeah.
So every day I cannot not do it. So wherever I am, I suppose it's a good corrective. I'm not going to get blind drunk of an evening or something, because, you know, I think I've got my diary to do. But actually, it also is a leveller, because it means wherever I am, I cannot not do it. So I couldn't then say, I've had such a busy day, I can't write the diary. The fact that it's been a busy day is the reason why you need to write the diary. And so therefore, if it's a non-negotiable part of your life, then you don't think, as you say, I'll just do it in the summer, or I'll take some time off and do it. If you have to do it, you will do it, and you can never not do it, and therefore, before you know it, you have a significant output.
Absolutely. I've been keeping a diary since, I think, 2006. Mm. I worked at Orion when we did Michael Palin's first set of diaries, and I remember reading them thinking, I've met all these incredible people and done so many wonderful things, and I'm already forgetting it, you know. So if I get it down on paper, at least when I pop my clogs, it's there for my kids as well. But also I find that at the end of the day, it helps me sleep, just getting all the jumble of thoughts out of my head and onto paper. I don't do it every single day, but it's almost every day. And it's and it's handwritten as well, and I handwrite my books too.
I was going to ask, actually, yeah. So is that because that's, you know, growing up as you did, because I know we're about the same age, that everything, certainly when I was at school, and even actually when I went to university, I remember the very first year, everything was handwritten. But is that the reason that you do it by hand, or do you just actually prefer it in terms of, does it make you a better writer?
I prefer, I don't know about better writer, but I think it makes me more productive. Mm. I think there's just a much more direct line between my brain and the paper than with a keyboard. And this is quite a recent development. I've done it in sort of the last 5 or 6 years. I used to type up everything. But there's something about, even on screen, even on, you know, when we're using a word processor or whatever, there's a kind of permanence to it. When you've written it, you think, that's kind of almost set in stone, even though I know I can delete stuff. And when I'm writing by hand in a notebook, and I have a separate notebook for each project, there are mornings where I will start writing and going, okay, what happens in this scene? I need so-and-so to happen by the end of this, or what thematically is important in this scene, blah, blah, blah. And just through going through, which I would never do on screen, but by doing it in a notebook and allowing myself to cross things out and scribble and go back and put little notes and circle things and whatever, that gets the cogs turning. And that, you know, I did, you know, 1,100 words this morning on a novel. So, you know, it just helps. And then what I do then is then I type it up. So I'll do, you know, I'll handwrite something, then type it up. And in typing it up, it's already like a first edit, if you like. I'm already tidying it up. So it leads to quite clean first drafts as well. But I just find I have this, it seems to have, where I used to be kind of paralysed thinking, well, I need to get this right first time. Now I'm just like, sod it, scribble, scribble, scribble. And it's writing without fear, writing without doubting myself, just allowing myself to get it wrong. And there's no going back after this.
Well, absolutely, yeah, indeed, because I'm thinking also, of course, that the misery scenario, of course, you know, in the film, where, of course, if you only have it written on paper, then, you know, that is the only copy, so I'm relieved to hear that there is a process that it is stored in a way, because I find all my old diaries, because I used to handwrite them until just over a decade ago, and it occurred to me once that I could move house one day, and, you know, what happened if those diaries were lost,
because
once they're gone forever, so now, of course, I have multiple backups.
Oh, no, I don't have backups of mine, but not of the diaries, but of my work, definitely. Back up 3 times. But It's a process that it has evolved and has changed and may continue to do so as well. But it's at the moment, it works really, really well for me.
And of course, it's worth talking about the Witches of Woodfield, which I suppose is your most famous, would you say, as we've used the word output already. I mean, that's
famous,
what you're
famous
most known for.
Relative term, I think. It's maybe, I don't know. I mean, there's, it's difficult to say, but... yeah, I've written a couple of movies. I've written a series of books. I'm working on the third part of a trilogy. What's been nice is I was at the MCM Comic Con recently, and I've been doing that for about 10 years. And this was the first one actually where I had quite a few people going, "Oh, I love these. Oh, these. I've read through it. Oh, I need to get the new one." Whereas before, it's always me been pushing it out, saying, "Try this, try this, try this." Now they're coming back for more. So I don't think that makes me famous, but I think it means I'm finally getting somewhere. But yeah, The Witches of Woodville is, I pitch it as Dad's Army meets Bedknobs and Broomsticks. And it's set in a little fictional village in Kent during the Second World War. And while the Battle of Britain's raging overhead, you've got this trio of bickering witches who can't agree on anything. And they've got to join forces to see off different supernatural threats. And they're really good fun. They're fun to write. I'm working on the proof pages for the fifth one now, which comes out in March. First one's called The Corn... next one's called The Corn Bride. The first one's called The Crow Folk. And for years, I'd had this idea. I read the Fortean Times a lot, and I had this idea of having a village where strange things happen and someone was investigating them. And it was going to be almost like a British Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And it was set in, you know, contemporary times, and I couldn't get it to click. It just couldn't work. And then we moved here to Herne Bay. And, of course, Second World War's everywhere here, pillboxes, airfields, what have you, museums. And I thought, okay, yeah, Second World War. And it sort of all clicked. And it's a period that I love, that I know about. It gave it a kind of a remove, you know, in time that allowed me to make it a little more heightened and give it that Bedknobs and Broomsticks, Dad's Army kind of humour and tone. And I'm a big Terry Pratchett fan as well, so there's a big dollop of Pratchett in there too. And, yeah, they've been really, really good fun to write. I really enjoyed
them. Do you have to do a lot of background research for the history there, I suppose, because you're not technically writing, it's not like you're recreating the events of the day, but do you feel that you have to do some research?
Well, because it has to be, for me, it has to be very much grounded in reality. Mm-hmm. And unless, because if you don't, then the fantastical stuff just seems, you know, it just doesn't work. If you've got to believe in the characters and believe in their environment, so when they're encountering strange things, you're kind of in their shoes. And you can get bogged down in research. I got a lovely tip from Ian Rankin, who said he always did the research after the first draft. So if he ever hit anything, I mean, obviously he's writing police procedurals, investigations, crime novels, but he said if he ever got stuck and thought, well, how does that work, I'll do that at the end, because otherwise you end up going down a rabbit hole and not actually writing. So I'd finish a first draft and I'd go, okay, how did that work? What was rationing? What was this? What was that? Actually, one of the most difficult things to find out was how much a round of drinks costs in a pub, in an English village pub in 1940. And I came across it in a George Formby film. And it's just, you know, I'm lucky in that the period that I'm writing about was thoroughly filmed. There was a lot of film. So things like Powell and Pressburger's Canterbury Tale is really useful, because a lot of those people are non-actors as well. I mean, part of the problem with anything filmed in the 40s is everyone went to that and spoke like this and received pronunciation, and that's not how people actually spoke. So, you know, you've got those non-actors in the Canterbury Tale, which is where, you know, you've got a farmer who says, yeah, because it's one of those things. Did people say yeah then? Did they say okay? I mean, okay was very much a military term that became part of the language. And there's a farmer that goes, yeah. So, great, that gives me license to do that. And yes, you know, watch a George Formby film and someone orders a round of drinks and it's, I can't remember what it was. I just remember scribbling it down going, yes, that's it, I'll use that. So it's the little details, the minutiae, the day-to-day stuff that makes all the difference.
Yeah, you made me think as well, actually, because I don't sound like a lot of people I went to school with. And when I go back to my hometown...
Neither do I.
Yeah, and I think, well, why is that? And, of course, I used to be so obsessed with the radio in those days, and the people on the radio in those days did sound quite posh. And so I'm wondering if, in some ways, I was channeling that sort of, you know, I was so interested in the way that they talked that, in some way, I was emulating that. And it's only sort of many years later when I was talking to some linguist friends who were like, obviously, this is a put-on accent. And I said, no, this is how I've always spoken. And they were like, oh, okay, you're an anomaly. I'm very proud to be an anomaly.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. Like I said, I grew up in London, working class family. My wife knows when I speak to my family on the phone because I turn into a Cockney geezer again. But then we moved to Surrey, and I couldn't win because when I moved to Surrey, everyone thought I was common as muck. And then when we go and see my nan, who lived in Thamesmead at the time, she'd say, "He don't talk like us, do he?" I was like, "Hello, Grandmama." You know, so I sort of stuck between these two worlds, and acting throws a spanner in the works as well, because then you start learning accents. And you have to talk in, you have to learn sort of receive pronunciation so that you can play a part in an old cow play or whatever. You know, so I do things like Blythe Spirit and stuff like that. And then, you know, you'd do American accents and all kinds of other stuff. So it completely screws up your accent. And my kids now are, I mean, my son George, who is an actor as well, used to get called Posh Boy at school, which, you know, you go back a generation or so. I've been doing that family tree thing, and I discovered my great-grandmother was born in a workhouse in Wandsworth. You know, proper Dickensian stuff, you know. So it's weird, that sort of journey. And so I do sort of cling to that work, even though I live in a nice converted barn in the middle of the country. I do cling to that working class thing.
Well, and you've reminded me, because you did pick Nuts in May, is that right, when you were on the film programme? I mean, what was extraordinary, I remember watching that with my mum. It would have been on TV in 1990 or thereabouts. And what we couldn't work out is whether they were actually actors.
Yeah, and of course they
were, because obviously one of them was Alison Steadman. But what it felt is that it was slightly mannered, as Mike Leigh's characters often are, that they speak the sort of working class, but there's
That's Life Is Sweet, not Nuts in May. Life Is Sweet, yeah. That was my choice.
But Nuts in May was the one that I watched.
Well, Life Is Sweet has an argument between, I've forgotten the names now, between the mother and the daughter, where she says something like, "Have you been nicking my cotton wool balls again?" Which is verbatim a thing that my mum and my sister would argue about as well. And I was like, "Mum, come and listen to this. They talk like us." And it was like, because I never really got on with EastEnders because that was, no one swore in EastEnders. It was like, this is so unrealistic. They'd all be effing and jeffing. So it was, you know, it felt real to me in a way that I hadn't, you know, before, you know, that, although they are, you know, working class, aspiring middle class kind of family, which we were sort of stuck in that trap as well. So it's, anything like that, seeing yourself does make a huge difference, I think, you know, which is why there's been this kind of, you know, struggle for non-white actors, you know, anyone who's not a nice posh person who went to a nice school and then went to a drama and could afford drama school, you know, there's a lot of, you know, very talented but white posh people working as actors now because they're the only ones who can afford it, you know. So it's seeing yourself like that makes a huge difference.
And do you think your younger self would be surprised that you're doing... Because, you know, you are living that dream. You know, you're doing what you wanted to do from a young age, certainly in terms of the writing. But do you think your younger self would be surprised to see what you're doing now? Or is it sort of exactly on... Is the arc... Because obviously you write fiction, but it is the arc, the character arc, one that you'd recognise?
I wanted to be an actor first and foremost because it was the easy option. I told you I was a lazy, lazy person. And I thought acting's easy because you just, you know, learn your lines, which I was good at. I had a knack for. You show up and you do that and it's fun. But I clearly wasn't on that trajectory to become a great actor. So I turned to the writing. And I tell you, I was, when we were filming Robot Overlords, we shot some of it at Pinewood Studios. And I just turned 40, and I was there with my friend Jeremy, that friend I knew from school who encouraged me to do it. He was working on the behind-the-scenes video. And so there's my old school friend of mine. We're standing on a studio, a soundstage at Pinewood Studios, and they're shooting a film that I've written, blue screen science fiction adventure. And, you know, the same question came up. What would you know, the 12-year-old me think? And my reply was, what took you so long? Because I, like a lot of people, I thought it was going to be easier. I thought I'd get there quicker. I thought I'd, you know, the industry would, you know, see my passion and enthusiasm and snap me up. But that's not how it works. Mm. What works is plugging away, plugging away.
Because what I hear from you is that you did that. You plugged away and you did what you wanted to do. I think in my case, I did the actual opposite of everything. In other words, I thought, I want to be on the radio. So I went to West Wales, which is, you know, the complete opposite, because I wasn't going to... That the career that I wanted. So I followed a different career. But it's almost like life catches up with you. And certainly by the time I turned 50, it was almost like, no, in doing the actual opposite of what you want to do,
yeah,
you've now almost proven that you really do want to do the thing you want to do.
Yeah.
So I'm now... That's why I'm doing all these things now,
yeah,
with radio, TV, because it's almost like, well, I'm not going to have, you know, a second chance has sometimes come up, but there may not be a third.
No, although the other thing is, you know, the entertainment industry certainly is obsessed with youth and the new thing. Mm. But one of the things about publishing and the entertainment industry is actually you can still start out in your 40s, 50s, whatever. The number of authors I've met who, you know, wrote their first book in their 50s or 60s, you know, you can do that. But it's never as easy as you think it's going to be. It is hard. It is competitive. And you really, really got to want it. And this is the other thing, talking about my wife Claire and that drama school reunion. A lot of them thought they wanted it,
yeah,
and they didn't. And I remember going to, in my mid-20s, I went to an open audition for a shampoo commercial at the Astoria, you know, in Tottenham Court Road. And I went in there, and there was about 350 people, all better looking than me, younger than me, who really wanted to do this shampoo commercial. And I thought, oh, sod this. This is not what I got into this for. And that's when I said, you know, I said to my wife, let's start our own theatre company. Let's take control of what we're doing. Rather than waiting for the phone to call, let's put on our own stuff. Let's put on plays that we love. And that evolved into me writing my own stuff as well. And I've said the same thing to my son and daughter, both of, you know, my daughter animates, but she also writes. She's got, you know, we've been working on a middle grade novel. My son graduated from a university as an actor, and, you know, he's making his own stuff, because you either sit there by the phone waiting for destiny, which isn't going to happen. And when you dig down into I read a lot of actors' autobiographies. When you dig down into these overnight successes, there's no such thing. You know, it's usually the result of them plugging away at something for a very long time and meeting people and making contacts and getting a foot in the door. And for me, that was, you know, I got a part-time job at Waterstones in Dorking back in 91, 92, a Christmas job. That was my foot in the door to publishing. I thought, I'm in now. And they are not kicking me out.
Because there's something, isn't there, about the way adversity, tragedy, bad things, you know, it's the problem of evil, I suppose, that's with my theologian hat on, but can actually spark something creative, can actually make you a stronger, more resilient person. Because, you know, one of the questions I always ask in the podcast is whether it's possible to be nostalgic about negative experiences, which is a different twist on that, but the sense of almost maybe returning to one's roots. And almost like, yeah, because you can maybe get carried away sometimes. And I don't mean you, but I mean somebody who might be, you know, some of those writers or those actors who are at the top of their game, who might sometimes, you know, just forget that maybe the journey there, or at least for other people, wasn't always smooth. And they're the people who you don't necessarily want to know, because, you know, almost as though they've got to a level of fame and it doesn't necessarily make them better people because of it. And there's just that sense sometimes that if you know that it took a while to get to where you want to do, and, you know, it makes you more resilient, then you're a better person for that. And if you have like a diary that has a record of all of that, then that almost corroborates the fact that it actually happened, rather than creating a story around it, which you know, sounds good as far as a soundbite is concerned, but isn't inauthentic.
Yeah, biopic. I mean, we all build our own mythology around our past, don't we? And I mean, what, you know, we've been talking for a while now, and what I've told you is the short version. Yeah. You know, there's a very short version. This is the short version. There's a much longer version with all the ups and downs and ins and outs and everything. But I think certainly actors and writers and other creatives do self-mythologize. So I think that happens. I'm always very wary of nostalgia now. Now, hear me out. My thesis is that nostalgia is the slippery slope to fascism, okay? Mm. Because, and I think we saw this with Brexit, and we've seen it with various elections, and we see it all. Certainly if you look at, let's take Facebook, okay? And there will be people, it starts with things like, oh, wagon wheels were bigger back in the day, okay? Oh, isn't that funny? Yes, what an interesting observation. Things were better back in the day because wagon wheels were better. And then it will be, oh, Princess Diana. Oh, wasn't she? Oh, the people's princess. Oh, the people's princess. Then there'll be a picture of her with a Union Jack flag behind her. And then it will be, oh, we must remember, you know, our boys in the war. And okay, fair enough. Yes, we should. The sacrifices they made. And then you start seeing this kind of, things are terrible now, and it's because of foreigners. Mm-hmm. That's how it happens. You know, you see this kind of, I've seen this with relatives. And so I am very, very wary about mythologizing the past. And I appreciate I write in a genre that celebrates, you know, the few and our, you know, our greatest hour and what have you, and the Battle of Britain and things like that. But I am very aware that, you know, I don't want to be part of that nostalgia industry. I will always make it clear that things weren't better then. Actually, people were having a pretty rotten time. Yes, people stuck together, but This kind of thing, oh, we stood alone as an island. Well, no, we didn't. We had Polish people here. We had, you know, Free French. We had all kinds of people from all over the empire, from India, helping us out. We didn't stand alone at any point. We needed help. And in many ways, the war, the victory of the war, it was all downhill after that. Then we had Suez. Then, you know, the empire crumbled around us. So I'm always putting bits in the books that will say, okay, you think you know what this is, but actually this is, and that comes from the research, you know, finding those little things where, in the first book, there's a dissenter, you know, there's a man, there's a poacher who says, yeah, Hitler's going to win this war and we should just give up now. Which, a lot of people thought. a lot of people very high up in the upper echelons of the royal family and our government thought, yeah, let's give in. You know, so it wasn't all flag waving and patriotism. It was a bit more complex than that. So I'm always very, very wary of the nostalgia industry. Not to denigrate your fine podcast.
Well, no, perhaps actually not, because the podcast is not eulogising nostalgia so much as, you know, being aware that sometimes we do have that capacity to try and chart a particular sort of journey.
Yeah.
But actually, it's, I was thinking of Empire of Light, the Sam Mendes film shot in Margate, which actually, on the one hand, took me back to me being eight or so, and I remember that the period and the music and the fashions of that era when I was very young. But also you can see the racism that is very much in display, and how walking in the streets was not always very comfortable, and then you've got the representation of the police there, and you're thinking, gosh, if the police did that today, there'd be all these trouble. And you're thinking, no, that was the world. And then I was thinking, that I look back at the people who taught me in the schools, and you're thinking, hang on a minute, were they good teachers, or were we frightened of them? And there were teachers, and I remember them. And I had a reunion, actually, not too long ago, and we were talking about teachers, and suddenly everything, this picture was painted, whereby suddenly, it's like, do you remember that teacher? And we thought, yeah, he was quite good. And you thought, actually, that teacher clearly didn't like teaching, so they actually didn't teach us the novels, the English teacher teaches novels. We'd have debates every week, and we all loved it, because we'd have these debates. We're thinking, but he wasn't actually preparing his classes, and he wasn't equipping us for our GCSEs. So at the time, we all rated him the best teacher, but he was the only teacher who perhaps didn't follow the curriculum.
I mean, the thing is, it's never a straight line, is it? Yeah. But we're recording this the day that America is voting in a new president. So, when people say, "Oh, what period of history would you ever want to live in?" I'm like, now, just for the dentistry. Yeah. You know, I remember dentistry in the 80s. It was terrible. It's painful. It's much better now. So things are getting better, believe it or not. I know we face challenges like climate change, but actually people are living longer. We generally have better diets. We are finding cures for diseases and treatments for them every day. It might not be going in the direction that everyone wants it to go into, but things are getting better. Certainly worldwide as well. You know, more and more women are getting the vote and having the rights to, you know, to take the empowerment over their own lives in nations that used to, you know, used to denigrate them. So things are, that as a world, step back from, you know, our little country with its flag, step back and look at the world. Things are getting better. So I tend to stick to the positive and stay away from watching more than an hour of the news every day.
Well, and I have one more question, which I'll come to in a minute, which I think you've already answered, but it's all the more pertinent to ask, because I always finish that way. But just a reflection there. It's that sometimes we look back and maybe the past is not really synonymous with nostalgia, because there's often a gap, and you've highlighted that. Somebody who says, oh, there's something missing, we don't like, you know, often it can be a xenophobic response to something.
Yeah.
And there's something missing now, or something that somebody then thinks, oh, we didn't used to have that loss, or something was complete. Yeah. It may be a Christmas. Oh, I remember Christmas when we were young, but you think, you know, perhaps Christmas wasn't that. Maybe you didn't have all those wonderful presents that maybe you thought you did, because in that particular age, we didn't, you know, it was all a cash economy, and it may be that we didn't have the resources that we have today in order to get our children presents, whatever it might be. But the thing I was just thinking is that sometimes if there's something missing now, then sometimes we are inclined to think, oh, let's get something back that we're missing. And I think that's the mistake. Whereas if you listen to a wonderful song that you maybe grew up listening to, you don't necessarily want to go back to being 9 years again. But listening to that song can actually excite you, because it's almost like that's my, you know, there's that connection. And same with people. You're connecting with the people. You're not connecting with the 10-year-olds, because they were 10 when you knew them. You're now connecting with them as fellow 50-year-olds, but actually you've realised that you've got all these things in common, but you have a shared journey.
I mean, for me, it's about revisiting the person that I was. I watched a lovely documentary about John Williams, the composer. My first record, a lot of people might have had, you know, Wham or the Pet Shop Boys or whatever. My first record was the Star Wars soundtrack. And you know, I grew up listening to a lot of film music, and listening to his music takes me back to when I was five, to when I can remember every Star Wars film I saw at the cinema, and the where I was and the seats we sat in and everything. And that takes you back to a place of comfort, you know, when you're a child and when you're with a parent or whatever and having a good time. And that's the kind of nostalgia I can enjoy, but it is just a... I still live in the... I think you have to live in the now and think about the future. You can't wallow in the past. You can enjoy those little moments, but I think if humanity is going to survive, we have to keep looking forward. We have to have the imagination to move forward. And a lot of the political movements around the world that are causing trouble are the ones that are saying, oh, it's better then. Oh, look back then. Wasn't it simpler? And it comes across as simpler, because it's easier to look back at something and go, oh, yeah, I knew what I was doing then. Yeah. But the future is always a bit frightening. But we just need to be able to grasp the nettle a little bit and move forward and use our imaginations to figure out a better world to live in. And there's no sign of that in current politics, but I think people are going to come along and we're going to see some big changes.
Well,
that said, Trump might get in and we'll all go to hell in a handcart, but, you know, let's see.
Well, my last question was going to be whether you consider yourself, Mark, to be a looking back or a looking forward person, but you read my mind and you have answered that splendidly. So, as a prophet, as somebody who's just given this far more optimistic prognosis than many people would do, I think a perfect way to finish up our conversation.
Thanks very much, Chris.
Thank you. Wonderful chat. Thank you, Mark.